Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are novelist Richard Powers and author and environmentalist Bill McKibben. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Richard Powers and Bill McKibben.
Richard Powers is the author of 12 novels, including Orfeo, The Time of Our Singing, and The Echo Maker, which was awarded the National Book Award in 2006. His most recent novel, The Overstory, is a sweeping, impassioned tale of activism and resistance that is also a stunning evocation of and paean to the natural world. It was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Literature this year, among many other honors. Richard Powers lives in a house perched on a hillside just on the edge of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Bill McKibben is an author, environmentalist, activist, and the co-founder of 350.org, an international climate campaign that works in 188 countries around the world. His 1989 groundbreaking book, The End of Nature, was the first book to alert us to global warming. He's gone on to write more than a dozen more books, most recently Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? The Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, he's the recipient of the Right Livelihood Prize, the Gandhi Prize, and the Thomas Merton Prize, and holds honorary degrees from 18 colleges and universities. Please join me in giving them both a warm welcome to the JCCSF.
Now, this is a great occasion for me. I got to read The Overstory a year or so before it came out, and I got to read it a couple of times. I read it a couple of times in that year, and I just could not wait for its publication because I knew the effect that it would have on readers around the world, and because I knew the moment I read it that there was something very, very special and different about it as a book. And I'm going to ask you, impose on you a few questions just to kind of try and get at that. I mean, it is a book filled with wonderful human characters, 9 or 10 really memorable central characters, a kind of Dickensian profusion, but and some of them with great Dickensian names to match. But the new characters in this book that I can't think of anyone ever trying were trees. Mm. And there are trees as memorable as any of the humans in this book, maybe even more so. Yeah. Just talk about that. Talk about, I mean, that's a literary... That attempt to let the more than human world become a part of that story is a remarkable, remarkable attempt carried off with incredible success. But just talk about how it came to you.
Well, bless you for that start. And I need to take a small detour before I do
back
answer
up
the question,
then.
Which is, y'all have to know that while Bill and I have corresponded for a while, I didn't actually meet him face-to-face until 40 minutes ago. So this is a lovely thing for me to sit on stage... To sit on stage with a man who has done more for us and for our future, whatever shape it takes, than almost anyone, and it's such a. I wore my Vermont shirt as a special marker of the occasion. Our correspondence has been intermittent and colored for a while in a kind of friendly rivalry between the Smokies and the Adirondacks, and which offers the superior pathway into the universe. And I think it's great that we've been forced to meet on neutral territory.
In the shadow of Muir Woods.
Where they have a tree or two, exactly. Right. Where the land of the redwoods and the sequoias and the bristlecone pines and other creatures that put ours to to shame in some ways. As for this question of promoting non-human entities to true characters, to focal participants who have agency and will and narrative arc to them, you're kind to say that this is an innovation, but it's not. It's a return to something that actually dominated most of world literature for most of human existence. And what it is, it's an attempt to bring the belles lettres, literary fiction tradition of the last 180, 200 years, back into the fold, back home. It's really only the West, and only relatively recently, that we fell out of that. Up until that sort of, I don't even want to put a precise date on it, but we certainly see a lot less of it by the 1870s and 1880s in this country and in Europe. Probably in Europe we see a lot less of it before those decades. But before that time, it would have been unthinkable to tell any kind of story about who we are and how we got here and where we're going without making the neighbors a big part of that story. And so that's all that this book is an attempt to take the form of this aesthetic that's been so refined and is now so sophisticated in its exploration of the personal experience or the small group experience, And simply say there's a part of the story that we've externalized and ignored for too long. Let's see what happens when they come back into this form.
So talk about trees themselves.
Yeah, I mean, and my own conversion, not just as a teller of tales, not just as a maker of literature, but in my life, I mean, that same alienation, that same exclusion that characterizes the literary tradition that I inherited, characterizes our everyday life. I mean, in a sense, in a nutshell, that process of alienation, that process of human exceptionalism, that accreting myth that says we did this all ourselves, and we are the masters of what is happening and what is to come. We are the only interesting game in town. That sensibility is so deeply ingrained in us now that it's a shock to step out of it and say, I've internalized this. It's it's not actually true.
So what knocked you on the head to tell the story?
Yeah, a very large, very blunt instrument, about 20 feet wide and 300 feet tall. And that's why it's nice to be back in California to have the conversation, because it was a large escapee redwood in the Santa Cruz Mountains, one of the very few that wasn't cut in the Central Peninsula, that I stumbled upon by accident as an in a in an afternoon's attempt to escape Silicon Valley and the present that they've made and the future that they're very rapidly making, a long hike in the second growth forest of the redwoods, which is in itself a religious experience, and coming across one of these creatures that operates on a scale of time and material dimension so extraordinary that you can no longer sustain that myth that somehow the real world is the one that we've made.
That's the that's the right phrase in a way. We convince ourselves constantly that reality is the thing that's directly in front of us at any moment.
Yeah.
And yet we're now being reminded in very fundamental ways the world, reality is impinging on what we've decided was reality.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a part of the world where we turned off the power last week for several days because the world had gotten dry enough that we were worried the trees that had been there for would catch fire if
right.
we didn't.
Right.
That feels like a new moment in...
Yeah, yeah. And it is the moment in which that ethos that we've been talking about, the one that became ascendant 2 centuries ago and has been unchallenged in a way, the one that says we can have this in our terms, the world is not alive. It's a simple set of resources for the realization of this other thing that we're making. What we say is what what we're able to do is what we are morally allowed to do. All of those things now, we've reached the moment where that narrative inheritance is not working anymore. I mean, I've said it a number of ways, and one formulation is harkens back to something that I learned in junior high school about the three kinds of drama. Where does narrative get its tension? We know that psychological drama comes from people at war with themselves. You know, individuals that hold inside their own heads incommensurable values. And that's a great story, to have a person who's wrestling with two values that are so essential to them, but they're simply impossible to maintain at the same moment in a certain moral crisis. You know, I'm your friend. I am always going to be loyal to you. There's something horrible that you don't want to hear. What do I owe you as your friend? Do I owe you loyalty or do I owe you honesty? And when they're not the same thing anymore, that's a story.
That's a good story.
That's a tremendous story. We've told it a lot, mm-hmm. and we've told it very, very well. And we know how to read it. That's the other thing. Our powers of literacy depend upon recognizing that as a central mm-hmm. linchpin, as a way of decoding what's important in the world. As we go beyond that, the next classic way of telling a drama is you have a value and I have a
different
value.
Value. Yes.
And they're both defensible and they both make, they're both laudable and palatable and attractive to the reader, but they come into conjunction in a way where we simply can't hold them at the same time. You know, you are absolutely committed to liberty. I am absolutely committed to equality. Now we have the American political novel, right? And we have to figure out whether there's a quid pro quo or not.
No quid pro quo.
Forget what I said 2 hours ago.
Right. It's inoperative.
So that's a story, and the psychological novel and the social political novel are things we do exceptionally well. What we've stopped telling is this third form of drama, namely the human race wants things. Life beyond human has a very different sense of what's appropriate, what's feasible, what's desirable. That tension How do we live here with the neighbors who want and need very different things than what we want and need? That fell away. And it fell away because of what you were saying earlier. We thought we'd won.
Right.
Right? That war was
over.
There
was no other character.
We were the last one standing.
Right.
We're not answerable to them anymore. Right. And so that becomes a less interesting kind of drama. In fact, it felt for a while as a sort of nostalgic exercise
right.
when anybody would. It would be a sort of like Ersatz Jack London.
Right. It's like I was going to say, go read Jack London and White Fang or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's Call of the Wild. You know.
Until we manage to build a world where it rains 58 inches in Houston or it. You know, you have to turn off the power for because
precisely.
Your city called Paradise turned into hell inside
right.
half an hour, you know. Yes, all of a sudden, we're back in an old story.
Not only did we not win that war, but we're about to have our posteriors handed
to us. Yes,
in the most undeniable way. And now you see literature starting to change and starting to bring that drama. Of course, you know, I have to say, the science fiction writers never gave up that story, right?
Well, science fiction writers have always had to, I mean, it's been very interesting because they also had they had a whole series of insights because they were the only people who were trying to measure the scale of human characters against the sort of scale of the technologies and forces that we'd unleashed and sort of begun to conclude that human characters didn't stand a chance against
That's exactly right.
those forces.
The other place where you see this as a continuous tradition is in indigenous literatures
exactly.
and in non-Western literatures.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just us,
right.
you know. Us aging white guys who
but
are
back,
coming
back. But back to Greece, you know, back to some of the really old white guys, you know.
But so you see, to tell that drama, to reintroduce that drama as a central component of literary fiction, as a central source of advancing the plot, is to tell the conflict between two states of mind. One that might be characterized as a commodity-driven state of mind, and the other that could be characterized as a community-driven state of mind.
Well, talk for a minute, though, about the... because there really are trees that are amazing characters in this book.
Right.
What was it like to try and get inside the... I mean, I was thinking the other day, the last time I was down in Monterey to give a talk. They took me behind the scenes at the aquarium, which is a great place, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I spent a couple hours happily wandering around until I got to the octopus room, and there was a tank with the octopus, and we spent a good half hour just tentacling each other, you know. It was
just
one
like
of the
arrival,
more
right?
remarkable.
You put your hand on the glass there, and
it just could not have been more. And you had very much that sense of a different intelligence coming from a different place that wasn't like yours. What were the?
And it was an intelligence that we were relatively late in tweaking, you know, because we are so anthrocentric The idea that an invertebrate might have that much going on, it just wasn't in our paradigm.
That's it.
And it's taken us a long time to come around to, which is my setup for the intelligence of plants.
That's great. And at least an octopus is something that we sort of think of as animate. So.
We see it moving around. We see it making choices. We see, you know, these incredible individuals, like the one that's been filmed and immortalized that carries the jar around with it.
Opens it.
And then gets in the jar when things are threatening, you know. And it's created its own little mobile safe environment. I mean, that's demonstrable. We can see it. We can make analogies to our own kinds of intelligence. But it has taken us a huge amount of extremely tight data sets to convince the world that there's a whole lot more going on in the plant kingdom than we ever expected.
You're listening to novelist Richard Powers, whose new novel is The Overstory, and author and environmentalist Bill McKibben, whose latest book is Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You know, over-the-air signaling, underground resource sharing, complex and supple behaviors involving things that are absolutely rightly described as memory, and you know, flexible behavior in the face of environmental change and, mm-hmm. and challenge. You know, all of, and in the assembly of data to illustrate that these things that until very recently we had pretty much trivialized or considered as fairly low-level automatons are actually deeply social, deeply complicated, and it's that recovery program that's at the heart of this novel. To get from commodity back to community, it does not hurt to look out into a forest and realize nothing is there by virtue of itself. And that's sort of the common denominator between what we've been working on from separate directions. Mm. I mean, not just in your own novel. And I really want to hear about your fiction experiences and the choices, the affordances of the one form versus the other. But also in Falter. I mean, so much of that book, I mean, the ostensible organizing principle is here are various ways that the game might be playing out. But there's a much narrower way in which all of the various, you know, seemingly diverse phenomena that you're exploring in that book, the common denominator of realizing that the notion of a competitive, individual, commodity-mediated, private meaning has given nothing to a long-term prospect, and to all of those explorations showing the ways in which that mentality, that human exceptionalist, commodity-mediated life, needs to give way to some other form of meaning that's actually out there, that's created in common.
That's right. The hyper-individualism of the world in which we live, which we've come to take for granted as the kind of water around us through which we swim.
And which we were projecting onto the natural world or justifying by a misapprehension of the natural world.
It turns out to be our great practical downfall.
Yeah.
We're now in literal hot water as we try to get out of it. And get out of it is an interesting, I mean, so I was an obvious sucker for this book because A, I love trees and forests more than almost anything on earth, and B, I, you know, have stumbled into the second half of my life spending my time as an activist.
Right.
And so here's also a crackerjack novel about activism and its, you know, but that's the, if we're going to get back to some world where we think about ourselves, where we behave and think about the world in some way other than as consumers and things, it's going to take some kind of movement building and work to change the world enough that that's a possibility.
A shift in consciousness that in my story I characterize as moving from plant blindness to plant consciousness.
That's right.
Yeah.
So talk for a minute about, but just, I'm reluctant to let go just for a minute.
You see what's happening here, right?
The whole experience. I'm reluctant to let go of the experience of, you're so good at character, and now you're encountering a tree. And of course, not a tree generic. Right. You know, I mean, trees are, there are young trees and old right. trees and deciduous trees and coniferous trees and diseased trees and whatever else.
Right.
But what is to be inside the soul of a giant,
right.
peaceful tree? What is that? Yeah. What was that immersion, that experience like?
I actually,
as a writer?
It was the most beautiful part of the process of making this book for me. To go from being more or less tree blind myself to realizing with a kind of visceral astonishment that there are 60 to 100,000 different species in a very loose taxonomy, you know, very distantly related, doing profoundly different biochemical things. And not only that, but the incredible variation within a single right. species. So to do this story and to build a whole human narrative, a generational human narrative around an American chestnut, for instance, that's planted by a Norwegian immigrant way outside of its native range. What does it look like? What does it feel like? What is its time frame? What is its relationship? You know, how is it feeling to the passage of seasons in a place that it wasn't designed for? And how is it relating to the rising and falling generations, almost like a Buddenbrooks saga of these Iowa farmers? How to find a narrative form that can tell two stories like that are so unfolding on such different time frames and such different volitional frames, you know, where desire and agency look so profoundly different. So when I do that for that American chestnut, and I absolutely fell in love with that species and felt in a way that I would never have expected, devastated by the history of the demise of that tree, America's perfect tree, you know, that ran from where you live all the way down to Georgia in such profusion, you know, one
the
out forests, of every four.
The forests are white, as if snow had crested every...
When they bloomed in the spring. And, you know, the notorious squirrel that could get all the way across the width of the continent, you know, without leaving a chestnut tree. You know, one out of every four eastern trees was a chestnut. And then from 1904 to 1940, have every mature chestnut in that range disappear.
And now you see, when you wander through your part of the world, through the Smokies, sometimes the skeletons of those hard trunks.
So a tree that died in 1940... is still sending up basal sprouts around the trunk that will live for 5 or 6 years until the bark fissures and, you know, it starts to fruit, and then the blight gets it. And that's been going on for, you know, 70 years now, you know.
Right.
80 years.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
so that's an incredible drama. But to inhabit that tree and to try to smell the smell and to hear the sound, and to watch the spiraling of the bowl, and to make that a drama, you know, while the people are, you know, doing this sort of stop action thing in the foreground, you know, that's one story. To come back to California and to send two activists 200 feet in the air in a tree sit to save this magnificent 1,500-year-old coastal redwood from a Texas financier who's selling off his inventory to pay off the debt that he acquires when he you know, pirated the land. That's an entirely different story. And to make visceral the species that don't live anywhere else except a football field high up in the air, you know, it was an entirely different, incredibly deeply pleasant and spiritual activity for me to try to realize. And it bears saying that, you know, this attempt to narrate the lives of human beings, you know, up in this canopy would have looked very different just a few decades ago when prevailing wisdom said there was nothing up there.
Right.
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 And, you know, and they're discovering 6-foot-tall hemlocks growing out of a lateral branch of the redwood, you know, or a pool where there are vertebrates, you know, salamanders that don't, you know.
I've kept thinking about it all summer, reading the accounts of what's happening in the Amazon and these vast fires, and just real, I mean, we sort of said, well, some acres in the Amazon burned, but no, I mean, this world that you so eloquently describe is disappeared across vast swaths of...
So that's right. So in telling this drama between commodity and community, I mean, what propelled me into the story and what propelled me to base it around this set of activists, none of whom were actually political prior to the frame of the story, right? But these average, ordinary people who suddenly have this road to Damascus moment and say, I need to put my life on the line. What could cause that? What causes it is what caused me to begin the book, which is the discovery that 95 to 98% of these original primary forests have been cut.
Yeah.
And only you know, 2 to 5% remain. And that there is a complexity of species and interdependence and interrelated processes. There are so many forms of life that exist in those ecosystems that do not ever appear again, even in a recovering forest that's been recovering for a long time.
It's and to watch those lives get turned around by that is remarkable. And of course, it reminds us that the people who are doing most of this work around the world remain indigenous people, protecting places that they never really lost that connection
with. More than 60% of the world's species
inhabit
are under the cover of under the protection of indigenous
people.
That's
right. And that's why when someone like Bolsonaro basically opens war on indigenous people, the pain of across so many levels.
Right. To some extent, you can almost excuse the narrative that unfolded on this continent with regard to those forests. We thought our four great forests were going to last forever. They went a lot faster than we thought. Mm-hmm. We also thought that they'd grow back.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that no human has ever seen an old growth ecosystem come back from a forest that's been cut. Ever. And, you know, people will give you a number. They'll say, oh, it takes 200 years, or it takes 500.
We don't really know.
We're guessing because we haven't seen it happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even if it does come back, it's not going to come back in the same way.
Thing.
And you know that famous Aldo Leopold line about, you know, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is don't throw away the parts.
We have thrown away most of them.
There are almost no places to go to see those parts. Now you're thinking, so we blew it because we were ignorant. So therefore, the rest of the world is, you know, should see that. But it's our pressures that are extending this down to the rest of the world. I mean, in our banter about the superior ecosystems, I would brag to Bill that, you know, well, we in the Smokies, you know, we have more species of trees than there are in all of Europe, from Portugal to the Baltic states, which sounds great until you remember that, you know, that 120 species...
Go to an acre of Ecuador.
600 species in 2 hectares.
Yeah.
And they're going.
Yeah.
And they're going.
In real time.
Yeah.
In the course of a decade or two. And they're going because people are cutting them down, but they're also we've also raised the temperature enough that
that's right.
The possibility of the Amazon becoming essentially a savanna is now
a very real possibility. Yeah.
Would you indulge me for me? For me, this has been a great literary day. One of the things that I gave up a little bit when I decided I needed to sort of take up activism was a little bit of the great pleasure of getting to think of myself mostly as a writer. And so would you cap it a little bit by reading a passage or a minute from Overstory, because the words in this book are, look, this is a really special book. There are a few times in the course of a literary, the sort of progress of literature when something really, really profound interrupts the kind of normal flow of things. And
you're
this
making
book
it
is
impossible
that
for me
so
to
now read it. Yeah, read the damn thing, would you?
So I'll establish.
Set this up. For a second. Right. Yes.
Yeah. So the for me, the heart and soul of the book, the character who kind of ties these nine stories together, is a woman named Patricia Westerford, and she's born with a hearing impairment, and her folks don't diagnose it very quickly. It takes them a while to realize what's going on. And as often happens, when a child doesn't hear well, their speech is often difficult to understand. And that combination of reduced hearing and altered speech seal her or alienate her from her fellow kids, and the her classmates treat her roughly, and she's looked upon as a kind of monster. And fortunately, her father takes her under his wing. He's an agricultural extension agent, and he introduces her to the world of plants. And here's a place where she can understand, where she can, she doesn't need those modalities to make their way of life intelligible to her. And that high sensitivity to the green world, she earns the nickname Plant Patty, makes her able, when she goes on to advanced study and graduate work, it makes her capable of giving more credit to green things than her field is willing to give them at the time. You know, the sort of alpha white male gatekeepers and their view of forest as basically a set of commodities is challenged by a woman who goes out in the field and does the measurements and determines that there's this chemical signaling going across distances between trees. You know, when a given tree is attacked by insects, starts producing its own insecticide, and also sends these chemical pheromones across the air that alert trees at some distance to begin preemptively to produce the insecticides that are appropriate for the incursion. So what's going on here? And she dares to cross that threshold slightly, that scientific prohibition against anthropomorphism, and says they might just be cooperating. They might just be sending and receiving signals to each other. And, of course, that prohibition against anthropomorphism, which has done good and valuable scientific guardrail work over the years, shades off pretty easily into anthrocentrism. How dare you say that they're doing something that is the proprietary domain of higher animals? Right? So she's humiliated for making these assertions. She's drummed out of her field and goes underground, begins a series of odd jobs, and makes her way across the country. And what I wanted to read to you was when, as an older woman, she ends up in this part of the country, actually a little bit north of here. And you'll hear at the end of this passage a formulation that she has known through her study of the indigenous people's relationship to the trees of the region.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are novelist Richard Powers, whose new novel is The Overstory, and author and environmentalist Bill McKibben, whose latest book is Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In 1981, Patricia heads northwest. Giants still grow in pockets of old growth scattered from Northern California up to Washington. She wants to see what uncut forest looks like, while there's some left. The Western Cascades in a damp September. Nothing prepares her. From mid-distance, without any scale, the trees seem no larger than the biggest tulip poplars back east. But up close, she's lost in measurements opposite. All she can do is laugh and look some more. Hemlock, grand fir, Douglas fir, buttressed monster conifers disappear above her with burls as big as minivans. Even the runts would dominate an eastern forest. Down in the understory, Patricia's own body seems freakishly small, like one of those acorn people she made in childhood. Clicks and chatter disturb the hush. The air is so twilight green she might be underwater. It rains particles, spore clouds, broken webs and mammal dander, skeletonized mites, bits of insect frass and bird feather. If she holds still, vines will overrun her. She walks deeper in, crunching 10,000 invertebrates with every step, watching for tracks in a place where the indigenous language uses the same word for footprint and understanding. The temperature plummets as she passes through a thermal curtain. She swings her singing stick before her. The canopy is a colander stippling the beetle-swarmed surfaces. Sword fern, liverworts, lichen, things with leaves as small as sand grains stain every inch of the dank logs. The mosses are thumbnail forests all their own. More bushwhacking reveals the prodigious rot. Creature-riddled bowls crumbling for centuries. Snags, gothic and twisted, silver as inverted icicles. She presses on a fissure of bark, and her fingers sink in. Fecund putrefaction fills her lungs. The sheer mass of ever-dying life packed into each cubic foot, woven together by fungal filaments and dew-betrayed spider web, leaves her woozy. Mushrooms ladder up the sides of trunks. Soaked by fog all winter long, spongy green bays she can't name coats every wooden pillar to a height well above her head. The forest pulls her along, past the trunk of an immense western red cedar. Her hand pats the fibrous strips of a trunk whose fluted girth rivals the height of an eastern dogwood. It reeks of incense. The top has sheared off, replaced by a candelabra of boughs promoted to stand-in trunks. A grotto opens at ground level in the rotted heartwood, large enough to house whole families of mammals. She addresses the cedar in the phrases of this forest's first humans. Long life maker, I'm here. Down here. She feels foolish. But each word is a little easier than the next. Thank you for the baskets and the boxes. Thank you for the capes and hats and skirts. Thank you for the cradles, the beds, the diapers, canoes, paddles, harpoons and nets, poles, logs, posts, the rot-proof shakes and shingles, the kindling that will always light. Finding no good reason to quit now, she lets the goods spill out. Thank you for the tools, the chests, the decking, the doors and floors, the beams and paneling. I forget. Thank you, she says, following the ancient formula, for all these gifts that you have given. And still not knowing how to stop, she adds, we're sorry. We didn't know how long it takes for you to grow back. I have to make one acknowledgement there. A lot of that passage was inspired by the remarkable Robin Wall Kimmerer. Mm. And Terry and I had the pleasure of being on stage with her in Harvard.
She's, yeah. People who haven't read her work. She's
Braiding Sweetgrass. But a couple of things. I mean, one, the direct sense of the need for reciprocity, the need for gratitude, the realization that this is not a right, it's a gift, whatever we get from the non-human. And also very specific things like the throwaway line, the mosses are a thumbnail forest all their own. You know, when you read Robin, you know, she opened my eyes to something. She says the scale of size difference in non-vascular plants, from the smallest mosses to the tallest, is greater than that between a blueberry bush and a redwood. So, you know, once you tire of this forest, there's a forest, fractal exactly. Forest down there for you. But I also want to mention this direct address to trees. I mean, it's that point where the pragmatist and the economical-minded would most ridicule the tree hugger. You know, do you expect them to answer you? Do you think that, you know...
And of course, I mean, yes.
Well, you know, David Abram, the natural right philosopher...
The Spell of the Sensuous, one of the greatest books ever written, among other things, about the rise of the what happened when the Hebrew alphabet... took its current form.
Yeah, and he said to me... The reason I like that, he says, I also talk to trees. He says, no, I do not expect an answer. But when I talk to a tree, that tree moves from being an object to being a subject in me. I change myself. I make myself capable of giving it the sanctity that we ordinarily only give ourselves.
I find trees quite ready to... talk back regularly and often more eloquently than the people you encounter.
Yeah.
It's not like Twitter, you know, but it's, there's a, you know.
But for that, we also have to stop talking.
Yes, right. Exactly right. It does take some time to sink in. The question of just when you get to those huge trees, and this is very powerful in the book, the question of scale. Just being, and it makes me. Did you go back and read Moby Dick at any point when you were working on any of this? Because there's another. That's the sort of scale, and it feels, you know, the.
I have been so under the spell of that book my whole life that I think I was challenging his insistence on.
Confronting, dealing with this.
On knowing that the world is alive And it has a will, and we cannot read it.
Yeah.
And it's our duty to subordinate ourselves, to take our place as a single species in this incredible community.
I'm reminded so much of the first great piece of nature writing in the Western tradition, the God's answer at the end of Job, where that seems to be sort of, I mean, God gives this incredibly great tour of the universe, but in a very sarcastic tone that indicates that we're to, you know, we're sort of getting above ourselves. It's time for you to remember that you're a small part of a blooming, buzzing, cruel, mysterious, complex world.
So Bill and I have collaborated on something. I was asked by some musicians if it might be possible to produce a piece of music that would be some kind of companion to the work that I was doing in this novel. And I went to four writer friends who are all known for their environmental engagement. And Bill was one, Kim Stanley Robinson was another, Joan Maloof, whose marvelous books on trees were eye-openers to me. And I asked them all to contribute a favorite environmental text, and that's the one you gave me. Where were you when I built the earth?
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And Bill called it the earliest piece of environmental writing, in some ways still the best.
In the Western canon, anyway,
Yeah. That sense of the world saying to us, not so fast.
And of course, the thing about our time on earth is I mean, God gives Job this tour of the universe, and very sarcastic. Where were you? You know, did you lay down tell the proud waves where to break and no further? And Job, like all human beings up till a certain point, has to say, no, that's your... I mean, Job, at the end of this three chapters, says, sorry I ask, and I sit down now, you know, because people were always kind of small until we got big enough to take down everything around us.
Which is why that passage becomes so crucial.
Now it's a whole different...
Yeah.
And now we're able to answer God right back.
So a word about this book as a religious book.
Mm.
I've characterized myself as the most religious atheist you'll ever meet. But... You know, I'm deeply in sympathy with the etymological sense of that word, right? Religio, to tie back together. That's the project now, to tie back together. There's no autonomous thing called man, humans, there's no autonomous thing called nature. It's of a piece or it's not. It's not, you know, we're not going to be around if it's not
that
of a piece.
As that great Northern Californian Mr. Jeffers once said, that not man apart from, you know, and let's say...
Nor wilderness apart, right?
Exactly.
So that program, the green religion, is very much at the heart of the book. But I also want to say that the other thing that ties the two of us back together, you notice I've made several forays here unsuccessfully, but... You know, to remove the entire spiritual question, the entire question of this change in consciousness that we've been talking about, and just address, you know, staying within that framework of, you know, operationalism, what are trees to us?
Mm.
Well, if you Google the word drawdown and go to the site, which is this enormous consortium of very forward-thinking people who have said, all right, we're not doing so well on the reduction end of emissions. What can we do on the sequestering end? And you look at their 80 most potentially world-changing projects of sequestration, a good 30% or 40% have to do with trees.
Well, and we're finding out, in fact, I was thinking of you the other day because I was talking with the great tree scientist, Bill Mumaw, Massachusetts, who had new, you know, people have proposed this project of planting a trillion trees right. around the world to soak up carbon and things. And he was saying, yeah, I mean, there's some problems with that because we don't really have the land to do it on, and it's getting harder to get trees to grow in lots of parts of the world and things. But the biggest, what he said was, what we're discovering now, actually, is that probably mathematically you're better off, you're sequestering more carbon if you let old trees keep growing.
Beyond a doubt. And
the trees in their second quarter century were taking up more carbon than in their first, and in the third more than the
yes.
second.
And after a protracted period of forestry, that thought, that's dead stuff. You know, that's decadent. We
right.
have to get those
right.
old ones out.
right. Right. It's going to waste.
This is the revolution in right. thinking of what's happening in forests that's right. just been unfolded in recent decades.
And sadly, what we're actually doing in your part of the world particularly
yeah.
is cutting down trees, turning them into pellets, shipping yeah. them off to Europe, burning them to produce electricity and pretending that it's somehow carbon neutral.
Yeah, if you want a quick education on that, the documentary Burned is a very good place to start.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Including this gentleman as a talking head. But what we need is, you know, as Thoreau says, you know, breathe the air, drink the drink, taste the fruits, live in each season as it passes, resign yourself to the influence of the earth. We need as much study as possible as to what that influence is in order for us to resign ourselves to it, rather than imposing willful fantasy on what's happening in these ecosystems. We need
Amen.
To look and listen to them.
Amen to that.
Yeah. The crucial takeaway, I think, is the distance between us and the rest of the living world is smaller than we think. And let's use the words that we love to explain ourselves with to deepen our sense of just how much is going on out there in a planet that's alive and has to be taken seriously as having those problematic words that we ordinarily just apply to ourselves.
And then let's try to keep it alive long enough that we find out more.
That sounds like a good plan.
Thank you, brother.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were novelist Richard Powers, whose new novel is The Overstory, and author and environmentalist Bill McKibben, whose latest book is Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.